session number 17335, Reel 3.
Mr. Scrivens, Reel 3.
So the shunning intensified until I think about the 19th on my birthday, 20th to the 21st, on Hill 227, 12,000 shells landed in the size of two tennis courts and reduced the hill by a meter. It is now Hill 226 instead of 227. And they say that it was more concentrated fire than any battle in Europe, and possibly more concentrated than the Battle of El Alamein. More shells landed in a shorter space of time in a smaller area. And literally, the lads on that hill were literally buried alive. There was no doubt about it. And most of the forward platoons were absolutely wiped out. But I think, well, what was I? 50, 60 yards away. And the strange thing on that period, not a shell landed on the MNG platoon. And we then found out why, because the Chinese are very superstitious. We then found we'd sighted our machine guns on an old Korean burial ground. And we think that is the reason the attack was not sustained, because when they captured Hill 227, a machine gun fired tracer over our heads to a much higher feature, 355, which was the usual method of communication to tell the Chinese infantry their next target, and it was never followed up. We felt it was the reason that they had to come through us and cross sacred ground to them. And we found it on maps later on that it was a Korean burial ground. We wondered why the earth was softer, and a couple of chaps had found bones and skulls, but we never took a lot of notice of it at the time. But I think it might have saved our lives and the rest of the battalion's lives, because the Chinese wouldn't cross that piece of ground. They would go round it, but they wouldn't go over it.
And so the artillery fire started on the 17th, and then was it the mass infantry attack on the 19th?
Yeah, it was the night of 18th and the 19th, yeah. The mass attack. The first one was repulsed with Triffitt loss to their side and Triffitt loss to our side. And the second one, they knocked the battalion off the hill, 227. And the next morning, a company went and took it back, and the next night the Chinese knocked them off again. And by the 21st, the hill was uninhabitable because of the amount of shell fire, and there was no dugouts left and intact to form any form of shelter, and we only used it as an OP during the day. But for some reason they never followed it up to the rest of the front. They just destroyed Hill 227 and everything that was up there.
How frightening was the fighting for you?
The shell fire was very frightening because you can't do anything about Shofar. It's like an air attack. You can't do anything about it. But I personally never found a great deal of difficulty in defending the position because I had absolute confidence in my machine gun, and I felt I could take on a battalion single-handed if necessary.
So you didn't feel that the Chinese would overrun you?
Not at the time, no, because we were on battle sites in the end, but for some strange reason they never followed up the attack any further. They hit on a sideways and head on and sort of stopped and on the top of Hill 27 and stopped in front of us. And for some strange reason they never came on.
Did you take any Chinese prisoners?
No, I never take any prisoners personally, but the A and D company took Chinese prisoners. They seemed to be well clothed and well fed, but I think they were afraid of us for propaganda because they were told they would be ill treated and possibly shot.
What did you think of the Chinese as a soldier?
Well, they were either brilliant or doped up, and we felt they were doped up because they would even dig in front of a machine gun firing at them over barbed wire. They would dig in on the barbed wire, and you've got to be fanatical to do that. Because no amount of training would make a European soldier dig in on somebody's barbed wire. Just wouldn't happen. And the way they charge, the front wave is normally armed, the second wave is normally unarmed, and they pick up the weapons from their dead or wounded comrades, run into minefields, throw themselves on barbed wire. So the third wave quite often is armed, and the fourth wave is unarmed, and they again pick up their weapons from their dead or wounded. There was one funny incident that one-on-one attack. They were blowing, doing their famous Japanese banzai charge, blowing their bugle. And our major called for the bugler, and he said, "Blow your bugle back at him." And he said, "What shall I play, sir?" And he said, "Everything you effing know, bugler." And the Chinese, for a split second, stopped in their tracks.
Did he play everything in Europe?
Yeah, you know, Cookhouse, Reveille, Last Post, Farmer's Boy, all the regimental calls.
Any other incidents that stick out in your mind from those few days?
No, only failures of British weapons. A couple of NCOs fired the Sten guns at the Chinese and they didn't work. They were hand to hand, so the Chinese took them off them, re-cocked them and pointed them at them, and they still didn't work. And the failure of antiquated British equipment saved their lives. Because even the Chinese threw them down in disgust and pointed at them to go towards their lines, and they went a few yards and doubled up behind some bushes or trees and got back to our line. But I remember one funny instance early on when a young chappie who had obviously been teased by his section corporal, who had never went with him on this search and destroy mission across the Indian. He was coming up the hill on a stretcher and he went past my machine gun pit and he shouted to the corporal, "I've et my pineapples before what I went over, so you can't have them, corporal." And apparently this corporal had pinched his fruit from his sea rations. So this lad stuffed his sea rations down before he went across the river.
Had you been in much action before November 1951?
No, only the Prussian Operation Commando, which started on about the 4th. We'd fired at the enemy, seen the enemy, harassed them, and supported platoon or company attacks. But the real action came from October the 4th till about the 21st, 22nd of October. On this same patch of ground.
Any personal memories from Operation Commando?
No, only recrossing and pulling back and recrossing the 38th parallel about 10 times. I could swear I could find my own footmarks on the mud of the edges of the river Imjin. We went across it that many times.
And after the Chinese offensive of November, what happened to you then?
We stayed on that position till about just before Christmas. Well, I went on leave to Japan, to Tokyo for Christmas. Came back after Christmas and we were moved to a section of the front. Can't remember its name now. Further to the west and relieve Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. And where we only harassed the enemy. And it was in February when the king died. Every gun we had, artillery, 3.7 rocket launchers, which the Yanks call the bazooka, we had a Bofors gun dug into the hillside, and everything that we had, we were given a target and we fired a 21 gun salute, "The king is dead, long live the queen," at the enemy. And that was a funny incident, I thought. And we were told, you know, why waste the ammunition? Find a target. So we fired 21 bursts for our machine guns and the artillery fired 21 shells and our Bofors gun fires 21 shells. The riflemen fired 21 bullets.
So this section you took over from the Princess Pats was a quieter section?
No, it was. It determined it. As it was then when we were there in February into March. I can't think whatever it was called. It became. One of the, up until the armistice was signed, and well, the peace talks, which had never been signed that officially, we're still at war with North Korea officially. This piece of land, I wasn't there then, but the Durham Light Infantry took over from the Shropshire Light Infantry, and there was quite a lot of casualties sustained by the Durhams and the Black Watch, and I can't remember the other battalions that took over. I wish I could remember the name. It's
well, you were there January, February, March.
Yeah, yeah, but nothing much happened. We were there, only harassing from both sides. I wish I could think of the name.
As a machine gunner, did you go out on patrol?
No, we only went out on listening in front of our positions to find concentrations of movements. When we sort of went in a camouflage slit trench with a very small opening with filled gas glasses and radios, and reported any movements, and that would have been quite frightening if we had that to stay there, because the idea was the enemy would walk over you not knowing we were there. But no Chinese ever came when I was on that sort of duty. And you can't very well take a machine gun on a patrol because it's a bit cumbersome.
Were the trenches like First World War trenches?
Yeah. Yeah, they were like you see on that Blackadder program, more than what you see on the other program. Sort of, my particular one that I can remember the most was on the slopes, the spur of 227, was about 10 feet square, about 6 feet deep, with a roof of pine trees which we've chopped down and put on the top, then hundredweights of earth on top of that, and camouflaged it. And so there was an aperture with quite a wide frontage for the gun. And I would think a 25-pound or a mortar bomb could have landed on the top and wouldn't done much damage to us. But fortunately, none landed on the top, and we were able to just construct this between the quiet time, say from mid October to mid November.
Did you have any contact with Korean civilians?
No, only what I suppose would be Chinese, Korean Army conscripts who were reporters. They carried our on a A-frame man pack, carried our ammunition, stores, food, sleeping bags, etc. up and down the mountains for us when we moved. But the only civilians we ever saw was driving through villages or digging in the paddy fields.
How did you get on with the Korean porters?
Well, by and large, they were really glad we were there, I should think, from what we can understand. They never offered any objection about carrying heavy loads up steep mountainsides in all kinds of weathers. I think there was quite a good thing, but we were told, and it's quite often happened, that the Republic of Korean's army, they were called the ROKs, weren't very good because they were always losing positions. And that's the Americans having to take them back and prop them up and defend them.
We haven't said anything about air power.
Yeah, the use of air power all I ever saw was our own the fleet air armor as it was then, and the United States Sabres, a few Australian Meteors, and I saw one MiG flying very, very high. But we were never under any attack by communist air power. In fact, the only attack that we were attacked by air power was by the Americans themselves. We laid out an air panel for the direction of attack on this hill, and these Sabre jets came over and did a rollover and came back and strafed us, even though the arrow was pointing the opposite way. And just before we got to Korea, the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders were inflicted very heavy casualties by American air power. But I never saw, other than this one MiG very high, and it was heading for home as fast as it could fly.
Did that attack by the Sabres on your lines do any damage?
No, fortunately it didn't to us, but it did a lot of damage to the Argylls, the Southern Highlanders. Unfortunately, all their rocket fire and machine gun fire missed us, went over our heads behind us.
After that period from January to March, when you took over from the Princess Patricia's, what happened to your unit then?
We came home because our service was coming to an end for DMOB, and the battalion saw quite a bit of action in the summer on this particular stretch of hills, which was the primary defence of Seoul, because that was the last sort of range of mountains, and there was a big valley going down to, and the main road going to the capital of South Korea, but I can't think what it was called. They gave it a name. It was a range of hills like that. I can't think what it was called. But
I think you were saying the battalion itself came home in
September. Yeah, the battalion itself came home in September 51. They were relieved by the Durham Light Infantry. Yeah, as for tank warfare, the British Centurion was far superior to the Russian T-34, and on any sort of conflict with the T-34, they just turned around and headed for home as fast as their engines would take them, because they didn't seem to do any harm to the Centurion at all, and it was the sort of tank that could do 50 miles an hour across a paddy field, bouncing and dipping, and the gun on gyroscope would stay perfectly on where it was positioned, and they could put a shell through the aperture of a machine gun nest, and the tank swerving and bumping. It was a marvellous piece of machinery.
You're talking about the Centurion?
The Centurion tank, yeah. And I think the American Sabre outfought the MiG. And I think our weapons, even though mine was antiquated, was superior to theirs. I can't think of
it. You were talking earlier about the cold of the Korean winter. Were the British troops adequately equipped for that by the time the winter of 51, 52 came?
Yeah, on the winter of 51, I would say categorically we were the best equipped soldiers in Korea of any nationality. Our winter clothing was fantastic. We could lie out in 40 degrees below and still be warm. We wore about 6 pairs of gloves. Our boots had an insole in with the socks that sort of kept the heat in. Our parkas folded right across, only exposed our eyes. The only thing was breathing, they froze up and we had to chip it off. They all open it up, and you daren't take the more than 2 pairs of gloves off, and only exposed to trigger fingers, because if you touch metal, it took off about right down to the flesh, took the skin clean off your hand. If you picked up a razor, but some of the lads were stupid enough to try and shave and pick up a razor, and it had to be removed from their hands, because it actually froze to their hands, and they got a sort of a third degree burn. It was that cold, the metal. But all our equipment, except the vehicles, everybody's vehicles were in trouble, but our clothing was fantastic.
Did you stay healthy, or were there any sicknesses?
I personally never had any sort of illnesses at all, and I'd never heard of any where I was, but there were stories about all different types of things, but I think they were only stories which soldiers tend to elaborate on. I personally never saw any disease or things like that.